This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
You know, it's a big story in our world when we create a daily running and constantly updating report on the Bloomberg, and we have and are, when it comes to the dramatic collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX crypto exchange, which wiped out about $200 billion in crypto market value. So let's get the latest on this constantly evolving story.
We've got with us Katie Greifeld. She's a Bloomberg News senior markets reporter, also the co-host of Crypto IRL on Bloomberg Quick Take. She's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So Katie, over the weekend, I don't know about you, but I was glued to Twitter in a really unhealthy way.
I know, more so than usual.
Yeah.
I mean,
you were, or you knew that I was?
I think I can speak for both of us.
Yeah.
More so than usual, glued to Twitter in an unhealthy way. Part of the reason why is because Sam Bankman-Fried is tweeting.
He's tweeting right now.
I know.
He's tweeting this kind of cryptic thing, right? The word what, and then he's spelling out in one letter at a time, H-A-P-P.
Yeah.
Which seems to be, you know, what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it makes sense that you're glued to Twitter because a lot of this is playing out over Twitter. You think back to this time last week, you had CZ and Sam Bankman-Fried, SBF, tweeting at each other. That's where this all started. And it's just such an fast evolving story. It's hard to keep up.
But where are we?
Where are we right now? I mean, we know that FTX is under investigation. We know that regulators, or rather enforcement in the Bahamas, have spoken to Sam Bankman-Fried. If you look at what's happening over at Binance, CEO CZ is apparently setting up this recovery fund, but he hasn't really offered any details on what that means. It's a little bit of a victory.
I heard somebody in the newsroom, whose name will not be mentioned, say, what is it? Like, all of a sudden Binance is like the Federal Reserve for like crypto?
Yeah, right, the lender of last resort. Is this like their duty to do this? I don't know. But in any case, CZ is definitely taking a bit of a victory lap here, calling out the bad actors. But the question everyone wants to know is, what is the next shoe to drop? And no one really knows the answer.
What do you mean by that? Like another crypto firm to go under? Layoffs? What are you talking about there?
Exactly. I mean, a lot of attention is being paid to crypto.com, for example. That's another exchange mistakenly sent something to the tune of $400 million. I think it was worth of Ether to the wrong address. So people are watching all the other exchanges right now. You have a lot of attention being paid to the lenders, such as BlockFi.
Which is owned by FTX or not owned by
they
FTX?
They had gotten a rescue line from FTX. So right after this news broke, everyone was looking at BlockFi. They did halt withdrawals. What happens with Genesis, one of the biggest remaining lenders, remains to be seen. And just who has exposure? I mean, that's the drip feed of news.
The crypto market, if I look at our monitor on the Bloomberg, I mean, it looks like it has stabilized, at least for the moment, right? We're not losing ground today. We've got what? Bitcoin. I know you were on air with me and just watching Bitcoin, you know, go down and down, go, you know, further. It's below 17,000, but above 16,000.
See, that's the thing. And I think that's one of the, I don't know, everything is interesting right now, but it's more, maybe one of the more puzzling things is, why isn't Bitcoin down more? It's obviously down a lot. It's already fallen a lot this year, but I don't know. I have said this a few different times. If you had told me that FTX was going to file for bankruptcy, I would have said, okay, that, I mean, Bitcoin below 10,000 obviously did not happen. I was wrong.
What does this mean for, I mean, there have been articles over the weekend about potential repercussions that Sam Bankman-Fried could see. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking bigger picture here, Katie, like what it means for, since he was the face of crypto, his face was literally on advertisements in San Francisco. FTX was on the Miami Stadium. Crypto.com is on the Staples, formerly known as the Staples Center, is crypto.com. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does it all mean?
I think it's important to watch what's happening in terms of the exchanges. There was a story on the Bloomberg today that exchanges have seen billions of dollars in outflows. I think you're seeing a big retreat among holders. They want to take their money off exchanges. They want to go to cold storage. They want control of their keys. This big centralization that we've seen in crypto, which, you know, there's been a lot of jokes like, oh, it's not so decentralized after all, but maybe you're seeing sort of the unraveling of that, because you are seeing this big push that people don't want to be on exchanges anymore. They want to have control of their keys, control of their Bitcoin.
Which is what I thought it was supposed to be about initially when I think about it. When you start to get other players involved, it becomes a different thing.
Exactly. I think it was part of the growing pains of trying to create new investors in the crypto sphere, was this push towards centralization. So I think that's going to be one of the storylines to watch over the next few months.
I also wonder what it means for the other firms that SBF and FTX went to, you know, quote unquote, rescued, right? He was seen as the white knight in the, with the collapse of Three Arrows Capital,
Voyager, 3AC, for example.
Voyager. And, you know, what happens to those firms?
Yeah, I wish I had an answer. One of the ways I phrased it, maybe it was to one of you earlier today, I can't even remember, is basically it would be easier to talk about the projects that SBF or Alameda or FTX wasn't involved with. If you think about
Was not involved in.
Yeah, if you think about the extent of
his
empire.
Because he had so many.
He had tentacles in almost every corner of the space.
And there's a great, you know, write-up in the Financial Times over the weekend, and then Matt Levine took it on today with the balance sheet of
Serum?
FTX.
I had not even heard of Serum.
I had neither.
Yeah. And,
but also the Robinhood stake, which is, you know, among the most valuable assets that the company has.
It's amazing. I believe it was $9 billion in liabilities, $900 million in liquid assets. I'm not great at math, but it doesn't seem to add up.
There's a hole there.
Well, and you do wonder if there was more regulatory oversight.
Yeah.
Would this have happened?
Did you just say the R word?
I did.
Regulation. I mean, we're not even talking about a U.S. company. That's another question I have, not enough for the time we have left. Bahamas-based, filed in the U.S. for bankruptcy. I don't know why.
How does that work?
I don't know.
God, the world is a funny place. As Katie said, a lot of things interesting in this one. Katie Greifeld, thank you so much. She is Bloomberg News Senior Markets Reporter and so much more. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So I'll walk into an Apple store and you know what you're going to get. White oak tables and neat rows at stores all around the globe. And yet what we're starting to see is some differences actually at some stores as Apple retail workers, Tim, are starting to unionize.
Interestingly enough, it's kind of mirroring what's happening at other companies and other stores around the country. We got Josh Idelson all over it in Bloomberg Business Week. His story is featured in the upcoming issue of Business Week magazine. You can read it now, though, on the Bloomberg terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Josh joins us on the phone from San Francisco. He's a labor reporter for Bloomberg News. Also with us right now is Joel Weber. He's the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So, Joel, what happened here? I thought the Apple Genius Bar and the Apple Store were great places to work.
So Apple, obviously the world's most valuable company, the thing that I think we've all assumed with that is that it is this great place to work. And the stores themselves, you know, there's the corporate and then there's the store, has never really felt like a retail environment. It's felt like a high concept store where, you know, you have these objects of desire that are on display in a very curated place. And, you know, obviously if you have a problem with those products, you have to go there. But it's never really felt like a retail job. But now the thing that's happened and what Josh's reporting is based on is that writ large, corporate America is going through this thing with labor. And unionization has really stepped up, and we've seen it at Amazon. We've seen it at Starbucks, as Josh writes about. And now we're even beginning to see it at Apple, specifically in the stores. So, Josh, bring us up to speed. What's changed in the stores?
workers who've been in these stores a long time say the culture has really transformed, and that these jobs in Apple stores have started to feel a lot more like retail jobs, in particular because of concerns about understaffing, an issue that workers say gets blamed by management on workers for calling out sick, and with upselling, this pressure to get people to spend more money, including getting people who came in with a device they wanted fixed to instead trade it in and buy something new, what the company calls an ownership opportunity. And workers have described ways that that performance on selling stuff to customers is measured, and that those measurements actually are shared with coworkers, whether it's in email or on the wall in the break room, and can be marked in red if your sales statistics are below where the company wants them to be.
What, was that a shift that happened recently, or is it a shift that's just coming into relief right now? I mean, where do we attribute this to, and when?
So workers say that things began to change after Tim Cook took over in 2011 and have changed in a more accelerated way since Deirdre O'Brien, the head of retail for Apple, took that position in 2019. Workers describe things like a bingo game to try to get you to sell Apple devices like the stylus, and the experience of being chided or having your commitment to the company questioned because you missed a chance to upsell a customer about purchasing AppleCare. And some workers who've been there a long time really feel like unionization is the path to try to protect the values that the company is supposed to stand for, and the vision of what that workplace is like for workers and for customers that drew them to the company in the first place.
Gotta say, Josh, it feels like, you know, going to buy a car like a million years ago, and they, you know, were selling you the roof, the rust undercoating, you know, make sure you kind of throw it in. That's what it felt like. And it felt so on Apple. Huh. Having said that, in your story, you say Apple's overall control over its workforce has having problems. It's really on multiple fronts. What's going on at Apple more broadly? You know, whether it's Foxconn, whether it's, you talk about the Maps app, there's a lot of stuff going on, it feels like, when it comes to Apple workers.
There's been scrutiny for a long time about Apple's international supply chain. More recently, we've seen Apple contract workers speaking up, including at an office that they call a black site, where workers said there were restrictions on even talking to direct employees of Apple. We saw during the pandemic some of the software workers becoming outspoken about issues from sexual harassment to return to work pressure to safety. And these struggles are connected. In fact, some of the software workers who alleged they were forced out of the company took road trips and went and visited the Apple stores and gave out cards with QR codes to encourage the retail workers to get in touch with union organizers.
So, Josh, I know some of this is opaque, but you know, the stores themselves, like how big of a portion of the company's bottom line do the stores account for? Because ultimately, one of the reasons that I thought this story was significant is like, look, like we're almost in the holidays here. You're going to go holiday shopping. An Apple store, you're going to, between AirPods and, you know, iPads, and you know, more often than not, you might find yourself walking through an Apple store. So how much of the company's revenue, which is considerable, gets broken out into sort of the retail bucket in general?
So Apple does not disclose how much of its sales happen in the stores versus online or other people's stores, but it reported record fourth quarter revenue, most of it from selling products. And as the story discusses, these stores have played a pivotal role in getting people comfortable with and excited about Apple's products and building a sense of loyalty and connection to the brand. As one expert put it to me, the store is also a temple to worship at the altar of the Apple brand. I, in researching this story, read an article about the launch of the Apple store in Towson, Maryland, the one that now, more than a decade later, has unionized, where Apple is talking about these stores as a place for people to get to know this company that at the time had a much smaller market share. Now Apple's market share has shot up for personal computers. And more importantly, they now have a majority market share in the US for that iPhone. And there's an incalculable role that the Apple Store has played in building that relationship with customers. And it's a relationship that some workers feel is being undermined by this pressure to squeeze more money out of those customers and at the same time to squeeze more labor out of these overstretched workers.
Well, it's a great story. And I know in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which will be out later on this week, our thanks to Josh Idelson. Josh is labor reporter at Bloomberg News with us on the phone and via Zoom from San Francisco. And of course, our thanks to the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. And again, you can also find this story at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg terminal. But interesting in terms of the evolution of what we're seeing here at Apple.
Yeah, and also just interesting seeing in the broader context of what's happening with the other companies that Josh mentioned, including what's going on at Amazon, what's going on at Starbucks. Starbucks especially, another one of those places where widely seen as a great place to work.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So among our most read today, how Presidents Joe Biden and Xi Jinping of China agreed to a series of goodwill gestures intended to improve ties between their countries after the first in-person meeting between the leaders of the U.S. and China since the pandemic began. Well, President Biden speaking earlier today from Bali on the possibility of China taking over Taiwan.
I absolutely believe there need not be a new Cold War. I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all.
That was President Biden speaking to the press after meeting with China's President Xi Jinping earlier today. We've got a great guest with us. Dexter Tiff Roberts is back with us. He's senior fellow for the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana. Also senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Asia Security Initiative. Also former Bloomberg Businessweek China bureau chief and the author of the book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, The Worker, the Factory, and the Future of the World. He joins us via Zoom from Missoula this afternoon. Dexter, good to have you back with us. What did you make of President Biden's comments following his first in-person meeting in years with President Xi Jinping?
Yeah, well, clearly he's trying to reassure Beijing that the policy hasn't changed. And you have to keep in mind, this comes after, I think, maybe seven separate statements by Biden that the U.S. would come to the defense of Taiwan in the case of an invasion by Beijing. And so that, not surprisingly, has gotten Beijing very riled up. So Beijing, I think they would welcome this comment, this support for the one-child policy. On the other hand, Beijing has been saying for a while, you say one thing, you, the United States and Biden, say one thing, but you actually act in a different way. And they, along with those other comments by Biden about supporting Taiwan in a military situation, there have been the repeated high-level visits by various, first by back in the Trump administration officials, and now those have continued, of course, most recently with Pelosi's visit to Taiwan.
Hey, you know, Tiff, you've written about China. You know China really well. And we talked about the book, your book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism. And I, you know, about the divisive system that was there that ultimately, you know, would be very challenging to the country's development going forward. How do you see it? I mean, is Chinese capitalism working, or do you see this is a big undoing, kind of the news flow that we've seen out of China over the last month or so?
I think they're, unfortunately, you know, they have not made progress on getting the economy to work better nor marketize it more. I mean, really, we've seen the opposite under Xi Jinping for a number of years now, actually, going back earlier, which is this increasing imposition of state control over the economy, continuing crackdown on the private sector. And, you know, today what they're really dealing with is they're sort of, the economy is suffering under the twin weights of both the continuing COVID zero policy, which is, you know, been good at preserving life in China, which is important, but it's been deadly for the economy, and then also the continuing property crackdown. So I would say, you know, they continue to struggle with the economy, and the policy really hasn't been going in the right direction.
Well, how do you take, because we actually talked about how Chinese ADRs that trade in the U.S. today were rallying, and this is because we saw a couple of things, some easing and help for the troubled and indebted Chinese property sector. And then on Friday, we got news about maybe easing of COVID-19, but it does feel like a back and forth with policy. So how are we as observers, not in China, how are we as investors supposed to kind of read sometimes a move forward, sometimes a step backward?
Well, yeah, I think that's what we keep seeing. And maybe, unfortunately, it's too often one step forward and two steps back. And I think with the first with the COVID zero policy, I mean, or the some signs of easing, obviously, they're welcomed. People have referred to them as baby steps. And ultimately, the challenge they face there is they announced these slight easings in COVID zero. You know, meanwhile, we've seen COVID surging across the country. Beijing, Zhengzhou, where the world's largest iPhone factory is, and down in Guangzhou. And they simply can't ease up on these policies until, first of all, they have a much broader vaccination program across the country, particularly with elderly people who have a low level of vaccination there. And it's not going to, you know, no matter what they say about easing, they're going to have to pull back until they actually start to get COVID under control. The smart money should bet maybe on certainly no serious easing until after the National People's Congress next March.
Wow, that's quite a bit of time, although it has been, you know, close to 3 years at this point that they've been dealing with this. Hey, Dexter, just in the last minute that we have, you know, you lived in Beijing for, what, 2 decades when you were with Bloomberg Business Week and writing your book. What do you hear from people on the ground there right now, people you're in touch with, about what life is like and how things have shifted over the last couple of years?
Well, you know, first of all, I think there is a concern, as we were discussing about COVID zero, the rolling lockdowns of cities are continuing. I think there's growing frustration about that, even though there has been, you know, there has been support earlier for the government's efforts to try to keep people safe. But we're starting to see that start to see fissures in that, if you will. I think the economy is a real worry about people. Mm-hmm. And there's also a growing concern about this politicization of the economy, this feeling that that politics comes first, and right, and you know, private entrepreneurs and elsewhere have to bend to that.
Hey, Tiff, I want to ask you kind of some rapid fire questions if I can. So China and the US, how would you describe the relationship and the way forward? Is it a good one?
Oh, I think it's actually a troubled relationship, unfortunately. It's really a competitive relationship. They are both see each other very much as their number one rival for global superpower status. And, you know, despite what they might say in meetings like the one yesterday between Biden and Xi, that is the reality.
So the Chinese economy, will it still be the engine the world has relied on?
I think, not great news there. I think that, you know, because of some of the things we discussed earlier, COVID zero policy, the crackdown on the property sector, but then larger structural issues, China's trying to make this transition from a factory to the world model, which was investment and debt driven, to a much more one driven by its own consumers, one driven by household consumption. And that's a really tough transition that is going to mean probably slowing growth for a number of years to come.
Are we seeing the world divided up? U.S. and its allies, China and its allies at this point? Or was it kind of divided up beforehand?
I mean, I think that it has been divided up, but I think we're seeing it slide further in that direction, two separate poles. I would say, though, that the U.S. has made some progress in the last year or two in terms of bringing more allies together. And, you know, China's helped in its own way on that as well by, you know, for just one example, its support for Russia related or relative support for Russia related to the invasion of Ukraine has turned a lot of European countries away from China and made them feel that they have more in common with the U.S.
So given the answers to your rapid fire questions from Carol just now, Tiff, what does it mean for investors? As I mentioned, we're getting earnings from Alibaba and JD later this week. The stocks that traded here in the U.S., the ADRs of Chinese companies, have really been getting beaten up over the last year and a half, although they've rallied recently. What does it mean for investors who want to be in the space?
Well, I'm afraid we're going to see more beating up of stocks. You know, Alibaba, for the first time ever, they just had their massive Singles Day, you know, our Black Friday of retail, online retail sales. And this is the first time Alibaba did not announce what the figures were because they weren't very good, apparently. I think that we're going to see, as I said, a continued slowdown in the Chinese economy. We're going to see pressures on big multinationals. We're already seeing it with companies like Apple to diversify their supply chain out of China, the latest, you know, lockdowns in Zhengzhou on the world's largest iPhone factory just show that. So I think we're going to actually have to see sort of a re-reckoning with global portfolios and the realization that China won't be the growth driver that it has been.
In terms of global supply chains, right, it's been, as you mentioned, Apple. It's been such an important part. It's given American consumers for many years the ability to pay, you know, not a lot for a lot of things that we all need. And we know it's been shifting to some extent over the last, you know, few years as China doesn't want to be kind of the manufacturer necessarily to the world. But does that mean in terms of global inflation, maybe it does stay higher because China is going to be very different going forward?
I think there's definitely going to be related global inflation. As companies feel the pressure to diversify their supply chains, partially because of the pandemic, partially because of the U.S.-China tensions, and partially just now the realization that it's not so smart to have all your eggs in one basket. There are going to be costs associated with that, and ultimately those costs will have to be passed on to the consumer as well.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Hey, listen, Tiff, thank you so much. Always appreciate Dexter Tiff Roberts, Senior Fellow with the Atlantic Council's Asia Security Initiative. As we mentioned, a former Bloomberg Businessweek China Bureau Chief, and his book is about the myth of Chinese capitalism, the worker, the factory, and the future of the world, and really gets into, I feel like, some of these issues that maybe are also coming through when it comes to the longer-term story for China specifically.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's get to it. We've got just about 9.5 minutes left in today's trading session. Charlie talking about you noticing too, Tim, just the rollover that we've seen in the equity trade. We described it as wobbly at the beginning of our broadcast, and it continues to be that way. And we are definitely off our best levels of the session right across the board.
Yeah, stocks moving between gains and losses more than a dozen at times today, but certainly seeing the downside with the S&P down close to...
A dozen times.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Look, searching for direction, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it with Dan Ahrens, Managing Director and Portfolio Manager at Advisor Shares Investment. Dan, this afternoon, joining us on the phone from Texas. Dan, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Hey, you've got a few plays that we want to talk about, and it's good to talk to you again, by the way. You've got the Advisor Shares Pure U.S. Cannabis ETF and some other vice holdings, but I want to get big picture from you before we get to those holdings. Where are we, do you think? Because we're getting sort of different narratives from different Fed speakers over the last 24 hours, and investors certainly don't know what direction things should be going in.
Yes, we see a lot of that. When there's is a lot of confusion, when there's lack of direction and people don't know what to do, I do think people should look at non-correlated assets like perhaps cannabis. But more than that, often consumer staples, things that might be recession resistant, stock market resistant, things that people are going to spend money on or consume, no matter what's going on with the economy or the stock market, because I'm not going to give you predictions on the future, especially when we see from the Fed and everywhere else, lack of direction. People shouldn't be trying to guesstimate that stuff.
Hey, when you think about it, because you've got, as you mentioned, different ways to play the market, and you do have a pure U.S. cannabis ETF, MSOS is the ticker, down 55% so far this year, but it's up about 14% over the past month. How did the recent midterms perhaps help that space or kind of just keep it neutral? Yeah.
Well, I can't shy away from the fact of those down numbers for the year, like you said. But cannabis, until the past month, has been in pretty much an 18 or 19-month drawdown. Heck, ever since Biden was elected, they made promises back then. But a lot of people are pointing to these most recent midterms. There's some ballot initiatives. Maryland just approved, passed adult use in the state of Maryland. That's a pretty populous state. Same thing in Missouri. So additional states continue to come online with cannabis. That increases sales yet again. But, again, we had politicians promising us various levels of cannabis reform. I always like to say reform because I don't think we're ever going to have a coast-to-coast full legalization everywhere. If you really drill down, alcohol is not even legal everywhere. It's a very convoluted legalization market.
Wait, hold on. What are you talking about? I mean, I know you can't buy it in the grocery store in certain states. What do you mean by that?
Great question. There's cities and counties that don't have package stores. You have to go to the a border to find a liquor store. Some states sell liquor on Sundays. Some don't. Some it's beer and wine only. Sometimes you can't buy it before noon. Sometimes there's locations that have bars. Some places you have to buy a membership. Some places don't have any. It's very complicated stuff. So at the most, cannabis might be something resembling that type of model. But we digress. In this lame duck session, you know, we just had these elections. What we ended up with, it looks like, it's not even done yet, is probably a Republican-controlled House. It looks like the Democrats are going to continue to control the Senate. And a lot of the experts feel that is good, that the current members of the Senate will finally roll over and do what's right, what they've been promising for the past 2 years, what the House of Representatives already approved,
yeah.
And that's some level of cannabis reform, such as safe banking.
I'm not going to hold my breath, and I'm not trying to, like, rain on your parade, but I feel like I've had this conversation a million times, and I'm thinking, depending on what comes at the world next year, which could be maybe a recession, some other hard times, I don't know.
Hey, I just want to say something about the Safe Banking Act.
Sure.
It's on the tip of my tongue, Dan, and you can probably speak to this too, but I was in California over the weekend, and I rode my bike by a cannabis store. And I think because of the lack of a Safe Banking Act, they deal only in cash. And there was armed security outside of it as a result of what they're doing with cash.
Because they have to.
And I thought to myself, wait a second, you know, if we do finally see... Because they're worried about getting robbed because everything is in cash. It's kind of crazy. Like, and this is, you know.
Oh, they're very, very much on point with worrying about being robbed. There's been armed robberies and murders happening in dispensaries because it's an all-cash business. It is outrageous, especially when these politicians have been playing games with people's lives over the last couple of years when – Democrats have had control of the Senate this whole time, promised to do reform, hasn't happened yet. That's why we think it's finally going to happen in the lame duck session. I mean, we have the American Bankers Association in favor of safe banking. Janet Yellen's in favor of safe banking.
Yeah.
70% to 80% of the population's in favor of safe banking. And a lot of people are finally pointing to, and again, I've sounded like a broken record for the past 2 years because I foolishly believed in politicians a little bit, but we think we might finally get it in the lame duck session.
Yeah.
And if you look at history,
right,
an awful lot of legislation is passed in the lame duck session because they're not. You know, most politicians' most important goal is to get elected or get reelected.
Yeah.
And that is finally lifted off during this little lame duck session.
We shall see. We shall see what will happen. But good to check in with you. Dan Ahrens, Managing Director, Portfolio Manager at the actively managed ETF investment management firm Advisor Shares Investments, joining us on the phone from Texas.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.